Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Jay Rosen is traveling this week, so I have a special guest co-host, Karen Woody, professor of law at Washington and Lee. I know you will enjoy her thoughts on some of the top compliance and ethics stories from this week in FCPA. And now I'd like to share with you a few thoughts about Ethisphere and their World's Most Ethical Company Awards. Do you work for one of the world's most ethical companies? Well, why not get the recognition you deserve for building a world-class ethics and compliance program at your company? You can do so by applying now to be considered for the 2022 class of World's Most Ethical Companies honorees by completing Ethisphere's online assessment. But more than simply completing the assessment, you can receive a scorecard that allows you to benchmark your compliance program against other honorees, and you'll also receive a 3-month associate membership to the Business Ethics Leadership Alliance if you complete the application by the November 12 deadline. To get started, download the free application guide and learn more about the process by visiting worldsmostethicalcompanies.com. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox. Welcome to This Week in FCPA, episode 269 for the week ending September 17, 2021, the focus on SEC edition. Jay is once again traveling, so this week we are joined by special co-host Karen Woody. That's Professor Karen Woody to those in the know. And I know you're going to enjoy her comments on this special focus on SEC edition because, amazingly enough, Karen is an SEC expert and one of her key areas of research, writing, and teaching. So, Karen, first of all, welcome and thank you so much for agreeing to be the co-host this week.
Oh, thank you, Tom. It's always such a pleasure to be on these with you.
So, Karen, we have a series of stories about Coinbase versus the SEC, and we've linked to them all in the show notes. But I was wanted to engage in a broader discussion with you about this issue, the public nature of the SPAT. What does the SEC's position, Coinbase? So maybe if you could kind of set the stage by telling us what is Coinbase and how did they at least potentially run afoul of the SEC and why are we seeing all of this in public?
It's a great question, and it certainly has captured everyone's attention in the last few months, but certainly has ramped up more recently. So Coinbase is essentially a broker-dealer for cryptocurrencies, and they have a number of different products that they have, but the one that is really sort of attracting sort of the regulators' eyes right now is what is being rolled out as a new service, which is called their Lend product, I guess. It's essentially lending consolidated cryptocurrencies is what's happening. And that, you know, is something that is problematic, I think, to regulators because they see that as unregulated and unregistered security offering. And so the SEC has clearly asked a few questions of Coinbase to figure out what is happening and what if this is meets the definition of a security, and if so, Coinbase would need to register that. And so just recently we've seen Coinbase's CEO, Brian Armstrong, sort of take to the wires, if you will, to get on Twitter and on a few blogs, it seems, to point out that the SEC seems to be poking around a lot, and if nothing else, not being very clear about what it is they're going to demand of Coinbase. But there's, you know, actually a decent debate over who is sort of more in the right here. according to Armstrong, you would think he's very much the aggrieved party, very much trying to, you know, just follow the laws, but the SEC hasn't been clear what the law is, that kind of idea. However, I think most people, certainly in the securities field, see what this lend product is as being a pretty straightforward security offering, in which case the SEC may be well within its rights to ask questions about it and to figure out what Coinbase is doing. What happened is just recently the SEC sent over a Wells notice to Coinbase, which is really the first step of the SEC starting an investigation. But at that point, it really is, you know, we need to have a conversation about what you're doing. You have the opportunity to defend yourself or explain yourself. If you receive a Wells notice, it's sort of an invitation to a conversation, but very much an indication that we're at sort of the 5-yard line before we initiate an enforcement action and certainly a wider investigation into what's going on. And so I guess in receipt of that Wells notice, Brian Armstrong sort of very much publicly created a record here of his, his disdain for the SEC's process under this. So that's where we are, I think, in terms of where we are. I have seen in recent weeks. It is interesting, and you pointed out the public nature of this. This is not typical. I mean, oftentimes Wells notices aren't, certainly not publicly known. It's still sort of behind closed doors a little bit. That's the nature of what's going on. It's certainly it's definitely an official document by the SEC, but it's not one that, you know, that is sort of openly, there's not a press release about a Wells notice. So the public nature that Armstrong took with this was a little bit not typical.
So what about Chairman Gensler, SEC Chair Gensler, testified in front of Congress this week? And I was trying to think of another time I had heard an SEC chair so publicly respond. And he did not name Coinbase by name, but he did all but that. Mm-hmm. Is that something you have seen? I was trying to think back, and it may even been around Enron, but I'm not even sure if there was a public testimony by the SEC chair around Enron. Why was Gensler so public? Was it in response to Coinbase, or is this something that just clearly excises him?
Well, my own opinion about that is that it's maybe twofold. It certainly was in response, I think, to Armstrong and just the idea of how much press this has gotten, and Coinbase being, you know, the first publicly traded, you know, broker dealer for crypto. So already Coinbase is very much in the sights of the SEC. People were already, you know, the SEC is already a little bit nervous about regulation of crypto, and Coinbase sort of is the biggest target for that. But, I mean, that sort of dovetails, which... with what I think is the other reason, which is, you know, this is a space that does feel a little like the Wild West, and the SEC is really trying to get its arms around it. So I think even absent maybe Armstrong's public comments, Gensler might have said something very similar, saying, you know, this is a problem, maybe not a problem, depending on how you see it, but this is certainly a new area that the SEC certainly thinks is crying out for additional regulation to ensure that investors are protected. Gensler's asking for additional rules and regulations from his staff on crypto. So I think either way, Gensler would have certainly said something. But you're right, this sort of public obviousness of who he was discussing is a little unheard of. But at the same time, Coinbase is sort of the first mover, at least to be traded on the market. So it was an obvious sort of jab.
Karen, could you go back to the Wells notice process? And back when you were in private practice, did you have to respond on behalf of a client for a Wells notice? And is there an internal process from the corporation to really get their ducks in a row and then formally respond and then perhaps sit down with the SEC and put forward your arguments to them? And you said about being on the 5-yard line, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to score. Can you sometimes persuade the SEC to go another direction or present them with legal or factual arguments that they might not have considered?
That's correct. So it is certainly an indication of the seriousness of it. And in my practice in D.C., there's definitely some truth to the sort of chummy nature, sort of revolving door of the regulators and the defense bar. And so sometimes there are sort of our conversations prior to a Wells notice saying, hey, you know, this might be coming down the pike. The Wells notice is a pretty formal document. However, as I said, it's not sort of the most, it's still the 5-yard line. You still have an opportunity to respond. It is a very formal response, you know, a long sort of documented response that the company provides to the SEC that does end up being discussed and enters into a conversation with the SEC, much more sort of on the record, a formal process as opposed to just sort of calling, you know, maybe a former colleague who's now defending the company, where that kind of what happened before the Wells process. And it is specific to the SEC. Other agencies have similar maybe processes, but the Wells notice in itself is what it's called at the SEC.
So where could all of this lead? Could we see an investigation and enforcement action? Could we see resolution? I think you and I at least are leaning to the position that this is a securities offering and there does need to be registration. But could there be a settlement and kind of everybody goes home getting half of what they wanted?
That's a good question. I don't really see how they still offer the lend product without registering it unless they sort of drastically alter it. It's interesting because Coinbase sort of wants its cake and wants to eat it too, in the sense that it doesn't want this to be considered a security, which is sort of a pooling of, you know, of investments and the definition of an investment contract that we see from an old case from the Supreme Court that, you know, involves pooling of assets and then a return and an expected return on the investment. At the same time that they say, hey, this isn't a security, this is just a lending thing, this is we're acting more like a bank, they also don't really want any bank regulations applied to them. It is interesting because it is actually, there's a second case that is actually maybe more applicable here, and that's what's called the Revis case. And in that case, that looks at whether or not a note is considered a security. So other than sort of a get-rich-quick scheme, this is one where it is exactly what Coinbase is doing in that it's a lending with a set return on that investment. So sure, Coinbase wants to say this looks more maybe like a note or like a loan, but there are enough factors that we saw from that case that is, like I said, the Revis case, that one makes clear that the term here is the family resemblance test. If this, you know, looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and in this case, duck is a security, that's how they get to this idea of, then you have to register that. And based even on sort of the facts of that case and what Coinbase is doing, it's so similar that I can't imagine anyone would come out any different way than thinking this clearly meets the family resemblance test and would be considered a security. So I don't think Coinbase has a very strong argument on their side at all. I appreciate that Armstrong really wants to get some sort of sympathy from sort of the masses of how, you know, what he considers an opaque process and that kind of thing. But this, the Lend product in particular, is one that I think is will have to be registered. So query what they do. Do they pull that product or have to sort of, you know, revamp it in some way that where there's not a set return on your investment to it? I'm not sure how they would rework it. And so I think they would have to go through a registration. I can't imagine they will want to do that, though.
Well, perhaps we could save that discussion for a later day because we had some other stories that I wanted to get to. Our first one is from Kyle Brasser, writing in Compliance Week, talking about one of the speakers at Compliance Week's ESG conference. And that speaker was Jim Massey, who was previously VP of ESG, Sustainability, Ethics, and Compliance at AstraZeneca. And he's now off in the consulting world. And he really talked about why compliance needs to lead the ESG effort. He said that he believes doing the right thing is the crux of being a good, sustainable corporation and a good leading corporation. And within the corporation, he believes compliance officers are perfectly positioned to get on with the sustainability efforts, or rather get involved. He said that compliance is not a defense, it's an offense. And more importantly, compliance works with a wide variety of corporate actors, so that it would seem to be a natural extension for compliance. So I've been advocating strongly that compliance really needs to lead the ESG effort. And I think Jim really gave us some additional points. I hate to say it, but is there another cheating scandal at KPMG?
Oh, that was a great article too. I'm glad Matt Kelly pulled that one out. That was it looked like it. I mean, they really were sort of taking each other's test, didn't it seem to be that? I thought that was very interesting, and maybe, you know, coincides with Kyle's piece about how, you know, compliance needs to be more proactive instead of simply reactive. And here we have someone who, there obviously was somebody maybe asleep at the switch who didn't realize that this was occurring, because it was a pretty pervasive cheating going on down in KPMG Australia. So, I mean, it's KPMG to the defense bar, I hate to say it, was really the gift that kept on giving. There always was something that you needed to help KPMG out, it felt like, when we were in practice. But it seemed that way, but it seemed that they were very forthcoming. They were very sort of contrite when they had been called out. I think they even met piecier remarks about their extraordinary cooperation with the PCAOB. So I hope they have seen the error of their ways.
Well, I'm going to have to say, in my mind, that's an open question, Karen. So next up, we have a really interesting article on leadership lessons from the fall of Kabul from Sandra Erez. And I'm going to, for the first time, give an award for my article of the week to Sandra for this piece. It's more than simply because of the content. It's her use of literature, of philosophy, of Greek myths, and a wide variety of other resources to really illustrate several different lessons to be learned from the fall of Kabul. She talks about Icarus and Daedalus flying too close to the sun. She asks, why do good people do bad things? She focuses on Immanuel Kant, The Critique of Pure Reason. I hope you have not had to read that. I had to read that in freshman philosophy. I'm still recovering from that. She talks about taking personal responsibility, and she does chide President Biden for, on the one hand, showing empathy, on the other hand, blaming the prior administration. But I really was intrigued by her ending, which is citing back to the ancient Greek theater, which is history repeats itself ad nauseum. And I couldn't really think of a better way to end this. But the lesson is that you have to close the curtain, you have to take the heat, and you have to move on, because what's past in the past, what is past is in the past. And that with this fall of Kabul, the fallout, Biden just has to take it going forward and go forward and learn whatever lessons he could. So really a great article, Sandra. Thanks for all the references. Karen, what are the three big issues in this year's proxy season? We'll be right back with more stories on This Week in FCPA after a quick word from our sponsor.
Oh, another great article that I appreciated you highlighting here. Oh, man. So I read this as sort of, you know, the big three of the institutional investors really are still pushing for diversity, equity, inclusion, so DEI, as well as ESG proposals on the proxy, on the proxies that we saw over this season, which they sort of estimated to be, you know, roughly July to this past June. And having looked at a number of these sort of Fortune 50 proxy statements looking at the same idea, especially focused on DEI, I've spent a lot of time this spring working on that type of a project as well. And so I find this such a great summary of what this past year has looked like in terms of what's been on the proxies. And, you know, how powerful, you know, the fact that these three institutional investors are when they have been really trying to put their money where their mouth is on these initiatives. And you see here this idea that, you know, they have voted even against, I mean, the one that really jumped out to me, that they voted contrary to the management recommendation at Berkshire Hathaway about requesting more DEI oversight to their policies. And, you know, they have just, this article had wonderful sort of summary statistics about how many shareholder proposals in comparison to previous years, and then certainly this year, dealt with things like DEI, ESG, other social issues. When I looked at some of the proxies for, say, Amazon, things like that, that was the, you know, certainly the majority of issues on the slate for the proxy, as well as other ones that we've seen that I think are still related to ESG, things like, you know, pay ratios, say on pay, more voice of from regular employees as opposed to only C-suite directors and officers. One of their proxies requested sort of an hourly employee to be in the boardroom, which that got voted down. Obviously, almost all of these still end up, you know, not getting a ton of traction. But the fact that the big three are really pushing this is, I think, is powerful. Obviously, we saw the NASDAQ rule come out this year too. So this is now sort of required for the NASDAQ companies. But I have to think that, you know, the buy-in from these big three is what is really what moved that needle a lot too.
So Karen, next up, we had an interesting article from Dick Casson over at the FCPA blog, and it was about corporate FCPA recidivism. And he listed 13 cases where companies had were two-time FCPA losers. I will note for the record that I've worked at two of those. I'm not suggesting there's correlation or even causation there. But he asked the question why these companies were recidivists. So in the two I worked at, I would certainly point towards a culture of that sales and business development were the most important thing over anything else. So I don't know about the other companies, but he really asks why companies would do this. And he concludes with a line from Professor Peter Henning, I believe. And Henning said that, quote, deterrence has little impact for economic crimes when there is so low a probability of getting caught, and concludes that perhaps these companies just didn't think they were going to get caught. Obviously, they were wrong because they did get caught. But according to Dick's numbers, 5.5% of all FCPA enforcement actions have been recidivist actions. So that's a fairly low number. But I think it is cause for looking at. But you do have to ask a question, is how can a company that has an enforcement action 3 or 4 years later? So you have to wonder about the culture of that company. Karen, in preparing for this week's this week's article, I came across a new term for me, the Great Resignation. So could you tell us what the Great Resignation is and why it relates to companies trying to give employees meaningful work?
Well, I think the Great Resignation, according to that piece you sent, was this idea that employees are fed up and they're done. They're leaving jobs sort of in sort of unprecedented numbers. And some of this is because, you know, we've seen sort of, back to your comment about culture, this idea that people want to work somewhere where they feel they have a purpose and that the work is meaningful. And so they, you know, rather than that being motivated only by the typical incentives, salary or other perks, we have this idea that this, you know, there is something deeper than that that motivates people. And that, you know, the lack of that being present in a number of maybe jobs is why people have had this great resignation to sort of, I mean, to find their passion, I guess, is what the takeaway was from that. I thought that was a very fascinating article. And I feel like we've seen some of these concepts teed up a little bit when people talk about differences between generations, that millennials are much more oriented and motivated by things that are bigger. Sort of they push things like the climate change initiatives and things that aren't quite as I would say the term selfish, but not necessarily in a negative sense, but just not necessarily as individual, but sort of broader themes and concepts that they find purpose in doing. So I thought this was a very, very fascinating piece.
Karen, next up, we have an article by lawyers from Wachtell Lipton in the Harvard Law School Forum on Corporate Governance, and it takes a look at a recent case involving Boeing and its board of directors. And it's a really interesting case. It follows the Caremark line of decisions that the Delaware Supreme Court has recently talked about, really putting a burden on directors to be involved with the risks of their organization. And, of course, for Boeing as an airplane or airline manufacturer, that should be the highest risk is safety. And this is a shareholder derivative action. And it's unique to shareholder actions. There could be an early resolution or at least an attempt by the defendants to end the case with, I think it would be a 12B6 motion, but maybe there's a special motion for these kinds of cases. But essentially, it's a motion for summary judgment or a motion notwithstanding the facts. And that's going to play into this case, it turns out, in a way that's a little unusual. But the court really excoriated Boeing's board in a way they don't typically do to boards for not only failing to elevate safety to the board level for oversight, but even going so far as to suggest that the board may have lied to investors and the public. And I can't remember a significant U.S. corporation being charged with that, at least by the Delaware Supreme Court. But what the procedural, and of course, being the complete procedure geeks that we are, I knew you'd love this, Karen. The because of the procedural nature of the pleading stage, the court had to accept the plaintiff's pleadings as fact. And so when the plaintiff said Boeing lied, the court had to accept that as fact at this stage. And so typically corporations use a 12B6 motion in shareholder suits to get it thrown out pretty quickly because there's no cause of action. But here, because of the pleadings, the corporation was not able to overcome those with counterfacts or any other type of evidence. So that was a really interesting part. But the Delaware Supreme Court has really toughened up and strengthened the Caremark decision, starting with the Bluebell case, Marchand, 18 months ago, and the article points out there had been six Caremark decisions in the past 12 months, which is very unusual. And if you're out there counseling or advising boards, they need to understand this is a real risk. And when you have Boeing shareholders suing the Boeing board, that's a real case. And I understand you may have D&O insurance, but nevertheless, it's Cognizant Technologies paid $95 million. Around an FCPA violation for their failure at their board level. So this could get very costly very quickly, and you don't have to get a $1 billion settlement. You can get 10 $100 million settlements. It can be very lucrative for the plaintiff's bar and very costly. So I thought this was a really interesting case for us to look at. Karen, next up, our colleague Mike Volkoff wrote about the intersection of culture and corporate reputation. And although I think that is talked about a little, I really appreciated Mike's focus on reputation. What did you see in this article that interested you?
Well, what I really enjoyed about this article was almost sort of the accounting nature of culture and of reputation. He's really using this as, you know, as he says even in the title, as an asset. And so it made me harken back to when I had to teach sort of basic securities laws to accounting majors, and I really wish I had learned more about accounting. I hope they learned more about securities law, but I do. I was such an interesting way to think through this idea that this is something that nearly could be sort of quantified as something that is so important to the company that it should go on, you know, nearly on the sort of on the balance sheet, in the sense that it is one of the most important assets that a company can have. So I thought that was an interesting sort of way to think about corporate culture as one of the most sort of long-standing assets. That was my thought about it.
So Karen, our final article really is an honor of you because it quotes Learned Hand. And for those non-lawyers listening to this podcast, Learned Hand is one of the most famous Court of Appeals justices. He was also a trial court judge in the federal system in the 20th century. And I think you teach torts. Do you still teach torts? And I'm sure Learned...
I do, yes.
I'm sure Learned Hand comes up at some point in torts. But our friend Jeff Kaplan, who writes the always great Conflict of Interest blog, quoted Learned Hand, not for a legal proposition, but for a business ethics proposition. And I thought it was pretty applicable, so I'm just going to read it. Learned Hand said, "The spirit of liberty is the spirit which is not too sure that it's right." And Jeff uses as an entree into discussing the need for humility within the business ethics arena and for the compliance practitioner. And that's something that I certainly ascribe to, that compliance officers need to have humility because there are going to be missteps in a compliance program because human beings are involved. And so I really appreciated that he really tied that to someone you and I have studied and probably looked up to quite a lot as a jurist, Learned Hand. So that concludes our articles. I'm going to run us through some podcasts and events. I'm going to start off with, are you stressed out as a compliance officer? Well, CCI, Corporate Compliance Insights, wants to hear from you because they're doing a survey about stress. So we've linked to it in the show notes. Henry Kronk wrote about it in CCI. We've linked to his article. I had my concluded my podcast series on looking back on 9/11. It was a six-part podcast series, very personal, very moving, looking at six people whose lives dramatically changed from 9/11, what that meant for them professionally, and then they reflected back 20 years later with some very personal and poignant reflections. I've rolled out a new podcast, and I took things in a little bit different direction. I, with my co-host, Greg Greenberg, Greg is the author of a book called Effing Argentina, and it's 11 chapters and stories of exasperation. So if you are exasperated, if you are overworked, overleveraged, overtired, overwhelmed, this is the podcast for you. We have some great stories. We go over some great stories Greg wrote. Episode one is out, and I think everyone with children can relate to this story. It's the dreaded parent meeting at the elementary school of your child's first elementary school. And we talk about things from the size of the chairs you have to sit in to the questions you have to hear to the questions you have to answer. And it's really a lot of fun. So I hope you'll check that out. Ethisphere has opened up submissions for the World's Most Ethical Company Awards for 2022. You can find out more information on the application process. We've linked to that in the show notes. And I have my new book out, The Compliance Handbook Second Edition. I've linked to that. It's also a feature on breaking news. So if you want to check out what breaking news had to say and learn why my daughter wants you to buy this book, I would urge you to check that out. So, Karen, that brings us to the end of this episode. This has been a ton of fun. I wanted to thank you again, and I hope you'll come back and join us again on This Week in FCPA.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you, Tom.
This is Tom Fox again. Thank you for listening to this episode of This Week in FCPA. Are you exasperated? Are you overworked, overwhelmed, overtired, and overstressed? Well, I have a new podcast for you, Effing Argentina, where with the book's author, Greg Greenberg, we take a look at 11 modern-day tales of exasperation. Effing Argentina is available on the Compliance Podcast Network. It's also available on video format on YouTube, so check it out. This Week in FCPA is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network. This is Tom Fox again. Thank you for listening to this episode of This Week in FCPA. I hope you will check out my six-part podcast series, Looking Back on 9/11, which is on the Innovation and Compliance feed of the Compliance Podcast Network. It's my most personal podcast series, and I hope you find it a good way to reflect about 20 years after 9/11. Please plan to join Jay and I next week when we take a look at stories that caught our eye. You can reach me at tfox@tfoxlaw.com, Jay at jrosen@affiliatedmonitors.com. This Week in FCPA is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.